if you don't mind, I'm talk a little bit about your childhood. You were born in Belfast,
yes,
in Ireland, and your dad was a riveter,
right,
in a shipyard, right? And your mom worked as well?
Yes, she was a winder in a flax spinning mill. That is to say, she put the flax on the bobbins that they put in the looms to do the weaving.
Was that common when you were a kid for both parents to be working to try and make a living?
Yeah, they couldn't do it on one thing at all. I mean, my dad, to give you some idea, my dad earned something like £4 a week, and the rent for our house was 12 shillings, and there were 20 shillings in a pound.
Wow, okay.
So he earned 80 shillings, and out of 80, 12 was already gone for the rent.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was all sorts of things that, I mean, just the food, clothes for the kids. I mean, shoes were the worst things. We used to play soccer with their shoes, you know, come home, and they'd all be scuffed up and holes in them all over the place. And mother would say, "Were you playing football in your good shoes?" "No, Ma." "How did that happen then?" "I don't know, Ma."
Boys will be boys.
Oh, sure.
So you were very poor.
Yes. Yeah, we were. I'm sure all the listeners have read the Angela's Ashes.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was like the hero of Angela's Ashes.
Wow.
And I went to quite a few concerts and things dressed in rags because we didn't. I mean, it weren't exactly rags, you know, but you could tell that we weren't rolling in money.
Sure. Did you know you were poor when you were a kid?
Not really. I mean, because it doesn't make any difference, you know, because everybody's the same.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought some other people were better off. But mm-hmm. we were okay. We were happy. And that was the main thing. I mean, even in Angela's Ashes, with a father who was an alcoholic, and he said to the kids, "Okay, we're all going to Rome or Italy or wherever they went." They called the upstairs part of the house Italy or Rome or something. And well, there was this sort of thing exists, you see. People fantasize about things. And I mean, my dad, he played the accordion.
Okay.
And he would play all these waltzes, you know, like Roses from the South. So half the time it was like living in Vienna, because all you heard was Richard Strauss all the time. And these, because he had to practice them to play them in the dances, you see.
So there was lots of music in your house when you were growing up.
Yeah, all the time.
What other than your dad playing the accordion?
Well, my mum, she expressed a desire to have a piano. And suddenly one of my more enterprising cousins arrived with a piano. Don't ask me where he got it. We didn't ask him either.
Yeah, you think?
Mind you, it was a bit of a wreck, but she could still play it.
Wow. So you really had a rich childhood, even though you were poor
mm-hmm.
in many ways. So what was your first musical instrument?
Was actually the violin. And this was an amazing thing. I expressed a desire to learn the violin. And a violin was produced by Mrs. Shearer, who lived up the street from us. And she just gave us this violin. But unfortunately, it was home sweet home for about 3,000 starving Irish woodworms. And they just chomped away there. As I played, I felt like Nero, you know. And every time you turned it upside down, all this dust would fall out. And then they won, so I gave up. But actually, I didn't give up because of that. I gave up because I had such terrible eyesight when I was a kid, because I have a congenital nystagmus, and I could hardly see anything.
Wow.
I could only see very close. And it gets a bit better as you get older, you know. When I'm about 90, I might sort of have better vision. But you get used to it, you see. But I couldn't deal with this, the violin and the music at the end of it. I couldn't see it.
That was going to be my next question. How do you see sheet music?
Well, with the flute, you can stick your nose right on it. You see, it doesn't get in the way.
Is that how you ended up playing the flute?
Yeah, that's true.
No.
Yeah, I took up the flute because it was handy, and we had one in the house. And my granddad played the flute, my dad played the flute, my Uncle Joe played the flute, half the street played the flute. We were all in these flute bands, you see.
Wow.
And my granddad taught my Uncle Joe the flute, so he taught me.
Wow, you really had a musical childhood and upbringing. What jobs did you have before you started playing the flute for actual money?
I was learning piano tuning and repairing, which everybody thought I should get something related to music. It was a horrible job, I thought. But but I got paid for it, you know, and I got used to doing it. And that's what I did for 2 years. And then I got a scholarship. You see, the British government decided to give underprivileged children in Northern Ireland scholarships. So we all went along and did our party piece, and a friend of mine got in the Royal Ballet. Another guy got into the Royal Academy playing the horn, and another one in the Academy playing the violin, and I got in the Royal College of Music playing the flute.
Wow.
For 3 years they gave us these things. Then I got an extension on mine, and I left the college and went to the Guildhall School to learn with another teacher.
And when you left school, you immediately began working as...
No, I went to the Paris Conservatoire, courtesy of the French government, who gave me money to do that.
Wow.
And I was in the French class. There's two classes. There's a class étranger and the French class. So I got in the French class because they had one place free, and it was competitive. So I won it, and it was great because the standard was so sky high in the French class.
And let's shoot forward a little bit to you being the solo. It says flautist here, but I know you don't like that, do you?
Oh, you can call me anything you like. I'm used to it. I've been called worse, actually. Much worse.
Okay.
And by very distinguished people, too.
I would think they're the only ones who would have the nerve. So you were the solo flutist with the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan.
Right.
All right. So how was your relationship with Maestro Karajan?
Well, very good until I told him I was leaving, and then he had a fit.
I've heard about this fit. What kind of a fit did he have?
Well, the first fit he had was when I told him I was leaving. And he got all the guys together and told him, look, you have to talk to Jimmy. He shouldn't leave. He definitely didn't want me to leave. And then as it got towards the point where I was really going to leave, disappear, he became very agitated and we became, let's say, the relationship became estranged.
Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra.
Something like that.
Wow. But was that healed a little bit later on?
No.
Never?
Once you break something with Karajan, he never forgives.
Well.
I mean, it's not a question of forgiving, but, you know, we weren't friends in the way that I'm friends with my wife or my brother. That's friendship. The rest is acquaintances. You know, these
Absolutely.
Sort of things where they categorize you, say, business, friend, or something else. They should have acquaintances in there and friends.
Right.
So you can put your brother and your wife and the friends and the rest in acquaintances.
Right. The category of people who won't call you back if you don't have anything to offer them.
Echo.
I've met a few of those, yes.
Yeah.
So you are known as the man with the golden flute, so... When did that start?
Well, it started when I was in the Berlin Philharmonic and when I got my first contract with RCA.
Uh-huh.
We had this guy called Robert Walker, and he was doing the publicity. So he put a little thing in a one-liner advert in the Gramophone magazine to say, what is an Irishman with a gold flute doing in Berlin? And things like this he put out all over the place. And then we made our first two records. One was with Marta Argerich, and the other one was called The Man with the Golden Flute.
Uh-huh. And what possessed you to make the first golden flute, or where did it come from?
Well, you know, Rampal was my big idol.
Okay.
I mean, we were all walking around. He was like the shepherd. We were all the sheep.
Is that so?
Yeah, but I just adored his playing. He was a wonderful player. And he was a great guy, too. He was so nice to all the kids all the time. It didn't matter who it was. And he had a gold flute, so I thought, I've got to get a gold flute. So I got one. And then I got another one. Then I got another one.
And how many are there?
15 or so.
Do they have a different sound?
Yes, they do.
How does it differ from...
Well, some of them are more... precise in the tone.
Mm-hmm.
Some are a bit more open.
Mm-hmm.
Some are a little bit more closed, perhaps. And some are more brilliant, and one or two of them have all of these qualities that you can coax out of them. I mean, a really good flute is a flute that you can play so that you can really not talk about the colours, but actually show the colours when you play. For example, if you play Danny Boy, you can play da 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 dee da 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 and o-da-da-dee-da-da-da, different tone.
Sure, I understand that. So there's different colours
right
in every note
to be had,
and to make that choice. I understand that completely. So I don't want to jump ahead too much, but recording the suite for flute and jazz piano is really an homage to Jean-Pierre Rampal for you?
In a way. Actually, when Rampal died, I did make a record which is called Homage à Jean-Pierre Rampal.
Really?
Yeah. I'm the only flute player who did it.
How do you decide what you're going to play at any particular performance?
Well, that's largely dictated by the number of concerts we have.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes we get a request from somebody to do a special thing. Otherwise, we say, look, on this tour, we're only doing the Ebert Concerto and Carmen Variations, that's it. Mm-hmm. And then you get some other guy who comes up and says, oh, listen, we had a 10-year-old who played the Ebert Concerto and Carmen up the octave last week. Can you change it for something else? So, you know, you do your best to oblige them without taking into account that you have to learn these pieces before you go on tour, and you have to maintain them in your repertoire while you're on tour. So that means practicing while you're on tour. And you have to look to make sure you can dedicate a part of each day for practicing.
That's an interesting point. So when you're on tour, there's rehearsal maybe in the earlier part of the day to keep everything fresh.
Yeah.
And do you generally use the performance space for that, or do you...
No. What we do is try and get to the concert venue the day before.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can practice a bit. Then you can practice in the morning before you go to the rehearsal. Then you practice in the rehearsal. Then you can do a little bit in the afternoon. In the evening, you've hopefully nailed it, as they say.
Why do you think it is that musicians, the way the industry has developed, are pigeonholed as one kind of musician versus another, whereas an actor is not, like Robert De Niro, is given more artistic freedom to have a range?
I don't know why we don't have this artistic freedom. But, you know, there's a lot of my colleagues don't feel comfortable playing folk songs or doing these sort of things. But the younger generation that's coming up now, for example, the piano players, they can all play ragtime, they can all play these sort of things, and they can all play Prokofiev's first piano concerto.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different world which we're shifting into now with the younger generation of musicians, because they can do all these crossover things.
And they're insisting upon
it. And they do them great too, you know. I mean, some of these kids are absolute murder on a keyboard. I mean, really just great. I get such a kick out of it.
You guys met when she was a student of yours?
No, she was never a student of mine.
Okay.
I met her in a pub. She doesn't like me saying this, but it's actually true. You know what happened? I went up to visit Julie Baker in 1977, and I just had a horrendous accident. I think it might have been 1958 because I was still using crutches.
You had a car accident, right? I saw only one reference to that in all the materials
motorbike.
That I looked at. Motorbike.
Somebody
okay.
hit me with a Yamaha 750.
Were you a pedestrian?
Yes.
Holy,
I had two broken legs and a broken arm.
Wow.
And a terrible headache.
I would think for a long time. Wow.
And I was recovering from that. And I went to, I was doing my first mostly Mozart concert. So I went to visit Julie Baker, who was a friend of mine. And I saw Jeannie there with some other kids, and I was showing them all my gold flutes and everything, passing them around the world, thinking this is great, you know. So then Jeannie came with some of her friends, and they asked me if I would like to join them for a drink or dinner. So I thought, okay. So I met them at this, I can only describe it as a pub because that's what it was. It was a bar with hamburgers, you know, in Danbury. It's the three-star Michelin guide hamburger
joint. Humans do tend to go to those kinds of places.
Yeah. So we got in there, and I got down to trying everything with a name of a color, you know, like Blue Lagoon and all that sort of stuff that they, you wouldn't drink it if you. So I tried all this stuff, and eventually, one of them had a car, so they drove me home. I was staying with Julie, and he had these two dogs. What are they called? Heidi and Max, maybe, or something like that. And they were Doberman Pinschers, and they were about the same size as me. So getting past these two guys, they get in the middle of the night drunk, you know. I was never so happy to shut a door in my life.
But getting back to meeting your wife.
Well, about a year or so later, I was doing Carnegie Hall, and I saw Jeannie in there, and I remembered her. I said, "Hey, what are you doing for lunch tomorrow?" She said, "Nothing." So I invited her to lunch, and she brought her friend because she didn't trust me.
What year was this?
It was 26 years ago.
Okay, so you were already very well known.
Well, apparently she thought so.
Okay.
Anyway, we had lunch and dinner and breakfast and everything else in between since.
That's lovely. You frequently commission new pieces to be written for you by other artists so that you can perform something new. How does that process work? Do you come up with a concept?
Yeah, well, I do. For example, I'm going to meet Lowell Lieberman on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And I think we have a slot in with him. And I want him to write something for flute, harp, and string quartet. You see, because my wife plays with the Cassatt quartet, and I'm going to get this commission for her as a present. And then she can play the Debussy trio for flute, harp, and viola. Right? And then they can get a clarinet player, and from that they can do the Ravel septet. So this would be a wonderful evening of very good, snazzy, high-class chamber music, plus a new world premiere.
So is that all the instruction you give to someone you're hiring to write a piece? You like his work, and you ask him to write a piece for these instruments, and that's as far as it goes?
That's it.
Fascinating. You were knighted by Queen Elizabeth in 2001, if I'm not mistaken. What is that like, especially growing up poor in Belfast and then being summoned?
It's amazing. Sometimes I think I can't believe that I'm doing the things that I do. You know, meeting presidents and things like this. And meeting the Empress of Japan, meeting the Queen, and all these sort of things. I mean, I can't believe I'm in like a sort of fairy tale world.
I can understand that. Do you still think of yourself? Well, let me ask you how you think of yourself, because you came from one place and you sort of reside right now in another place.
Yeah.
So how do those two realities meld for you?
Well, I'm slowly getting used to the transition because, you know, to give you an example, when I bought my house that I live in now.
In Switzerland,
It had all these big trees and a huge garden. So we had to have a gardener because I couldn't do it myself and I was not there all the time. So we got this gardener. So he's charging me an arm and a leg to do this stuff, right? And I told him, listen, I can only afford the arm. You have to do something about this. So I think he cut off a finger, but he still kept the leg and the arm. You know, it didn't make any difference. So then one day, one of my neighbors called me up and said, Jimmy, you know, why don't you hire a couple to work for you? Now, this concept of me hiring people to work for me is so foreign if you're a working class kid.
Yeah.
You just don't employ people to cook for you or to do clean a house. I mean, I had this Italian cleaning lady for 15 years. She was a riot. I mean, she knew more about flute playing than I did.
So how many rooms are in this house in Switzerland?
Well, it's about 26.
And you were
like
dusting,
that.
Were you?
No, I wasn't dusting. Gabrielle was dusting. But you see, when I looked at this thing, what I would get if I employed these two people, it would cost the same as the gardener. But one of them would do the garden and the other one would cook and clean. And Antonio would drive me and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So altogether, it was a good deal.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But it took me some time to get used to this sort of hiring people.
It just didn't enter your mind as a reality.
No. Yeah. I mean, if my ma saw this, she wouldn't believe it. She would think I was living in somebody's house for the weekend. Yeah.
How has your playing changed as you've matured?
Well, first of all, I take it very seriously, the whole thing. That means I practice a lot. And when I practice, I don't have a routine. You see, a lot of people have a routine, and they do that, and they say, okay, that's finished, done.
I see, sort of like doing a workout, and you do the same thing over and over again, and then you can move on with your day.
Mm-hmm. But, in fact, you're never finished. It's always work in progress. You're always trying to get something better. Recently, in one of my classes, I was talking to the kids about relating things to singing. Mm-hmm. Then I realized none of them can sing. You see, I can sing a little bit, you know, because I learned it at school. Because my first school that I went to when I was 6 years old was attached to the church, and they didn't have any musical instruments. So Mrs. McCaughey, who was in charge of our class of six-year-olds, she taught us singing. Uh-huh. And she had a little tuning fork, and she gave the A, and she could relate a F to that, or if we were going to sing in F major, she could give us the note, and we'd all sing. And at the end of a year, we could all yell at the top of our lungs several folk songs and a song by Schubert in German and all. You see, because these kids could not relate to singing, I got a guy in to teach them singing. And you see, when we applied his singing technique to our long notes, our long tones, not only did the tone improve, but they related how to engage a note and how to make the note project. And also the intonation got better because they were listening better, because they could sing a little bit and now they could relate the whole thing.
And there was more emotional connection.
Definitely, definitely. Because, you know, we played things like a simple melody like the Swan we played. And to hear this big class of 80 people play the Swan, it was amazing because you could actually hear something happening in it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand that a note has a size and there's a top and a middle and a bottom, mm-hmm. and it can have different colors and pitch to it.
Is the breathing you use to play the flute similar?
Yes.
Okay, so you need
the
apparatus moving.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Now, you are either the best-selling classical artist or one of the best-selling classical artists of all time. Are you recognized on the street, or can you have your... So you can have your career and you also your humanity, which is a remarkable gift.
The only time you're recognized on the street is if you do several things on TV and everybody sees them. Mm-hmm. Then you walk outside the TV place and somebody says, oh, I just saw you on TV. Day later, you can walk past the same thing and nobody knows you.
You are a lucky man.
So unless you're reading the news or unless you're Robert De Niro.
Lucky, 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 lucky man.
Well, the British stockade in Cuba was manned with a garrison there from Ireland, I think, and General O'Reilly was the guy in charge. It might not have been from Irish, but he was the guy in charge, General O'Reilly. And when the Spanish invaded, he fought them off and helped the Cubans. And, of course, he probably thought he was going to grab it for the British. And but they made a hero of him, and they called the street O'Reilly Street, and there's a famous Cafe O'Reilly and everything like this.
And how did you come to choose Tiempo Libre to collaborate with?
Well, the first thing was I had a problem to relate to the standard piano trio, you know, with bass and drums. That's the orchestration of the bowling suite.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want one of these nice drumming guys going along there keeping time and, you know, I wanted to have something different. And then I thought about Tiempo Libre. And then Jorge Gomez, he's married to Elizabeth Sobol, who's my manager. And for years, she's been giving me records of these guys. And I was listening, thinking, boy, this is one really very good band.
Wow.
You know, I thought they were sort of the equivalent of the Emerson String Quartet in the Latin business because of their ensemble was so great. You know, they're really tight band and great playing, especially from Jorge on the piano. He's a real genius on the piano. So I told Elizabeth about this, and we fixed up a session to see if we got on okay. Mm-hmm. So I told her, listen, tell the guys 10 o'clock in the morning, no spitting, drinking, or cursing. And
you've
no
met
smoking.
A few musicians, huh?
So the guys all turned up, 10 o'clock, and you know what they did? They played everything from memory. Wow. I couldn't believe it because, you see, they had to make the arrangements. So they'd make the arrangements, they'd practice with Jorge, and he would show them how it goes, and they would try, oh, maybe this is better with this, or, you know. And we played it, and it was like a fairy tale because we had a little Walkman and we made a disc of one number and we sent it to Sony. And they listened to it and they said, OK, we'll buy it, but we need it right away. And that was a big headache for us because they're a hardworking band, you know.
Oh,
every
yeah.
day,
they
something.
Have the gigs, yeah.
Yep. So we found 2 days at the end of a tour that I was on and in the middle of a tour they were on. And we went to Toronto and recorded in the Glenn Gould Studios.
You recorded the entirety of O'Reilly Street
yeah.
in 2 days of studio sessions?
Three studio session days.
Wow. How many were sort of one take tracks?
None. We all did, most things we did twice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was very difficult because Jorge is such a great player that every time there was an improvised bit, it would be different. And we were all getting excited, thinking, God, that's the one. That's the one. And then he'd say, oh, wait a minute, I want to do another one. You know? So we'd do another one, fit that bit. And I don't know how they chose it at the end, but, I mean, you heard him in the club, and it's fantastic piano playing by any standard.
How is the recording of Claude Bolling's suite for flute and jazz piano that you made with Tiempo Libre different from the one that we remember of Jean-Pierre Rampal?
Well, there again you have a sort of rather nice Presbyterian drum kit going on there where I have these two real raving guys here. You see, that's the difference. And then the bass player, my bass is electric. You see, that's the difference. And it comes out in the ensemble. You know, when they start to do the jazz bit in blues and jazz or whatever it's called, I forget the name of that number, and then they go, it's great. I mean, because, I mean, they launch into it absolutely solid.
Did you record the entire suite for flute and jazz piano?
No, we just chose ones that we thought worked the best for us.
So you did some of the movements and left others?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, you know, if we sell a few million of this one, we might make the other ones, do the other ones.
What else did you record on O'Reilly Street?
Oh, we recorded General O'Reilly's piece, and we recorded...
Written by?
Jorge.
That's...
Because the guys, they all compose these things, you
mm-hmm,
see.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of their compositions, and one thing that they do... They used to play the B minor suite, you know. They would play that as a number without the flute. But they actually do have a flute player, so I expect he might have played it in there.
Okay.
But they wrote a piece for me in it, and I joined in.
That was nice of them.
Yeah.
They included you?
Yeah.
What is the funniest thing that has ever happened to you on stage?
Oh, well, the funniest thing that ever happened to me, I think, was when my flute fell to pieces. You know, I was playing away there, and I thought I'll adjust the headpiece, you know, for the intonation. I had 9 bars rest in a concerto. And as I adjusted it, the headpiece and the socket that you put into it came off the flute, and I thought, oh, Jesus, what do I do now? Fortunately, my wife was watching this on TV.
You were on TV at the time?
Yeah, but only closed circuit, watching it backstage.
Okay.
You know. So she came out ready with another flute, and then the conductor says, where should we start? I said, what do you mean? At the beginning again. Well, I've done this before, you know. I did it and one time I was playing all the Bach sonatas, and halfway down the first sonata in B minor, I had this sweat ran into my eye and I could hardly see anything. And I just said to the audience, I've got to stop for a second. And I wiped all the stuff off, started again.
I think the audience really loves when an artist does that and sort of just declares their humanity or fallibility.
Yeah, well,
on stage.
Sure. Sure.
You have a most memorable thing that has happened since you've been performing these long years?
Yeah. There was one thing that happened in the opera. We were doing Carmen one day in Bournemouth, and there was a famous dog in Bournemouth that used, it was a big, big, white, shaggy dog, and it would do things like terrorize people in a phone booth. You couldn't get out of the phone booth because the dog was barking at you. Anyhow, we're playing Carmen and Don Jose singing away there, and the audience were started to laugh. And I thought, oh, God, maybe he split his pants or something, because you know, he's getting a bit round. And when I looked round, he was threatening Carmen and the dog got hold of him by the pants. The dog had walked in. The dog had walked in and saw on the stage, this guy, look at him attacking this girl. I'll help. Just led on him. And then he shook it off and he turned around to look at the dog. And you can imagine all the pregnant silences between the laughter.
Yeah,
the audience. And then this guy, you know what he did? He picked the dog up, put it over his shoulders and threw it out. I mean, it might have bitten his ear off or something. Yeah. But we think the dog didn't ever bite anybody. It just did its thing.
Wow.
But then we couldn't get started again. The conductor, John Matheson, he said, let's start at bar at figure 25. We said, we don't have figures, we've got numbers. He was conducting from a piano score.
Oh, Lord.
And we were playing the opera, you know. So anyway, it sort of gradually wound up and got going again. That was a funny thing. Then another thing, another friend of mine was playing a trumpet call on stage and he suddenly disappeared. Somebody opened a trap door.
No.
And he went right down.
Oh, was he okay?
Yeah, he was okay, but his trumpet didn't make it.
That's unbelievable. What are your plans for your 70th birthday that's coming
well,
up?
Well, I personally don't have any plans, but plans are being made.
Uh-oh.
Everybody's planning something. So it's going to be a very long 70th birthday.
Surprise!
Yeah, surprise.
Over and over and over again.
I guess I'll get used to it.
I'm sure you will.
I just wish it was 50.
Oh, I can understand that, but you'll get used to the adulation, I think. Before we went to tape, I was asking you about your love of somewhat snazzy shoes. Let's tell everybody you're wearing. They say Italia on the bottom, you guys, and he's got leather sort of sneakers, and they are gold and silver with white laces, and what do they say? Sort of, oh, Dolce and Gabbana, okay. And another one of your passions is wine.
Yeah, oh, I like wine, but I should really stop drinking so much of it.
Do you buy it at auctions?
No.
No?
No, I have thought of that, actually, because my son is really into wine, and he had a wine shop before he started doing the computer business, and he knows a tremendous amount about wine, and he often calls me up and says, listen, do you want me to make a bid on this in Sotheby's? And I think, well, you know, I have so much wine now, I can't even drink it. And I'm so happy when we have a party at home and I can get out a whole case and get rid of a case with my friends, you know.
You have one son?
No, I have two. Two sons and two daughters.
Two sons?
Twin girls.
And they were, how old are they?
Oh, 35 and 37 and 42 or something like that.
Well, and what do they do?
Well, one of them's in computer business, my son, and the other one is in the hotel business. One of my daughters is a waitress and the other one is a punk rocker. So that's it.
That should introduce you to some other forms of music as well.
Oh.
That's very interesting. What have you learned in your life that steers your moral compass?
Well, generally speaking, I adhere to the principles laid down by Jesus Christ and how to behave yourself and how to behave to other people. And you see this every day, you know, you see people yelling at somebody else and you think, well, would that person like to have the other person yell at them? You know, just this simple do unto others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what is most important to you as you approach your 70th year?
This is hard to say what's most important. My health, I think. I think I really have to pay attention, you know. That's why I'm saying I shouldn't drink so much wine. But I don't drink so much wine, you know. I only drink on social occasions when it's a party at my house. I mean, sometimes for a week or two I don't drink because there's only me and Jeannie, and she doesn't drink.
At all?
No, just water.
Is that your vice, is wine?
Yeah, I would say.
Now, I'm out of questions. I would like to know, is there anything, Sir James, that I have missed that you would like to include?
No, I'd just like to say hello to all the kids who are playing a flute and wish them all a good time playing and blowing the flute and torturing the neighbors there with their scales.
Not going to torture them as much as the budding drummers.
Oh, that's for sure.